Trepreneurs, listen, we have got a great podcast coming up. We have somebody that has been in the trades, and not just any trades, but carpentry, a master carpenter that is going to share with you his wisdom and his knowledge, just not about the trades and carpentry, but life itself. Welcome back to another episode of the Trepreneur Show. I'm your host, Patrick Summers. We've got co-hosting today, stepping in for Tanya Priest, my business partner, my friend, Francisco Rodriguez.
Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, I'm glad you accepted.
Excited to be here.
And then we've got a special guest today, of a tradesman himself, Tim Plentel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man.
Great to be here.
The trade you have been in your entire life, I assume your entire life or most of it.
Most of it.
Is carpentry.
Yes.
Okay. And carpentry is, and the idea came to get you on the show was we were having a conversation once. Mm. And we were talking about carpentry and how it's changed over the years and how construction has changed. And maybe I was expressing a concern that the carpenters are losing some of the skill set they used to have.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So why don't we start? I don't want to get into that more, but let's start your journey into the trades. How did it start? How did you end up in carpentry?
Well, like I was joking with you guys before we went on, I've been building houses since I was 5 or 6. we started basically with Lincoln Logs as children, and we would build these little log cabins and then tear them down. And I always kind of liked doing that. We would build forts in our trees and things like that. And all I used in those days was a handsaw because my dad didn't have any power tools. But then later on, as I got into middle school, I had the opportunity for shop classes. The really cool thing is that in those days, in public schools, they had a really vigorous shop plan. And in middle school, I got my first exposure to carpentry in using power, you know, shop tools, plastics, basic electronics, and even metalworking. And that's something that's sad that it's gone today. Something that'd be great if we could bring that back. But
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a budget thing.
You're a little bit older than me, but I think we're close enough that when I went to school, we had shop class. You know, and you learn to weld and you learn some carpentry. You had home ec. So if you wanted to go that route, you learn how to sew and everything like that. And where I live, we actually had a vocational technical school where you could spend half the day in your high school. And then they would bus you for another half a day. And you could learn. There was everything from computer programming to carpentry to masonry, auto mechanic, diesel mechanic, horticulture. It was really amazing. And I know they were pretty prevalent back in the day, like the 80s, and I don't really see them as much anymore.
Yeah. I think a lot of that is because you're from Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah.
And so that's a little more unionized, and so the unions had a lot to do with that, I think. California, it's not, especially Southern California, is not very, very union embedded. So being that everything's non-union, it was kind of up to the schools to do it. But, it turned into a thing where then in high school, we were able to actually get school credit for working outside of school. It was ROP program. So going all through high school, I basically worked all through high school and got some of my credits for my graduation from being a worker. It was pretty advanced carpentry in the shops, you know, in high school. And then I learned photography, which was great. Worked in a dark room and developed a black and white negatives. And you come out of high school knowing that you can do things tangibly with your hands. You're already with a confidence level at graduation that if I have to, I can work on my own car. In those days, they weren't computerized. So, you know, we had auto shop and we worked on our own cars. It's a little different now.
Yeah, it's a lot different now.
But as far as the carpentry goes, I guess I took a little break. I was working in the markets in high school, and I did that until I was 20 or so. And then when I moved up here to the desert, the construction industry was just booming up here. Yeah. And I got into it, and I've been in there since 78.
Wow. That's when I was born.
78. That's a long career. That's a long career.
Yeah.
Any regrets?
I think my biggest regret is that I got my contractor's license in 1986 and didn't really have a great deal of success. I didn't lose money, but I didn't really make a lot of money. And but it demanded a lot of my time from family.
Yeah.
And my wife at the time said, you know, why don't you give this up and go get a real job? And she talked me into going and working in automotive service, which I did that. And I just let my license expire. That would be my biggest regret, is that I had a license. For those of you who know anything about contractor's license, my number used to be 498-336.
Oh, yeah?
Wow.
So that's an old number.
Yeah, it's an old number.
And when you go to hire somebody nowadays, at least I do, I look at that number and I see how old it is or how new it is.
Yes.
And that tells you how much experience they've got. So 498-336.
That's awesome.
Longer than that one. Well, I think, and that's a big thing that we talk about on the Tradepreneur Show is, you know, there's a lot of people that go into the trades and they're very good at the trades and they want to transition into the business side of it. And they're two different animals.
That's for sure.
Right. And that's one of the things that hurts us in the trades, I believe, is when somebody wants to go into the trades and they make the move into the trades, not really understanding that they've got to learn business and they got to operate like a business. And they move into the trades, and now essentially so many buy themselves a job.
Yeah.
Right?
And you know what? That brings a perfect point, because we've had a lot of technicians that have gone on their own in business, and they can't grow past a one-truck shop. Yeah. So, right, because they don't know the business aspect of it. You know, we were speaking too, you know, we were talking about the ROP program.
Right.
I mean, literally, that's how I came into the trades, and that's how I came to General when I was in high school, because I was in the ROP program, and there was a sign for a delivery driver at General Air. And that's how I got into the trades.
Yeah, I think, and again, that's why, like, here at General, one of my goals is to start teaching, like, a business class. At, and not just me teaching it, bringing in other individuals around. Because if there's somebody here in our team that wants to start their own business, like, I'm like, okay, that's fantastic. Because that takes a lot. And if that's your goal, let me help you be successful, because at least if I can help with that, if you become a competitor, our competitor, now at least you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because so many people get into the trades and then they work for wages and because they don't understand business and there's a lot to know. And, you know, and not everybody's cut out to be in business, but, you know, if you're going to do it right. And so anyways, the carpentry trade, as we were talking, is, there's so much has moved to, like, we're talking, like, how many guys out there can cut stairs, right? How many guys can put a roof using the rafters and stuff versus just
conventional cut and stack, we call it.
Yeah. So how many out there can do that versus setting trusses? And to me, that's a craft that it makes me sad to think that that's a dying craft.
Yeah. Well, the only thing about it is from the angle of some of us who can do that is it still gives us value.
Yeah, well.
But, it's really transitioned. I know when I was a contractor, I had as many as 15 guys, and guys would come in and they had very little experience. I made sure that they knew how to nail with a hammer and nails before they got a nail gun. Nowadays, the guys, they get out there with a nail gun and they're just going, bam, 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 bam.
He's wireless.
And you can tell they don't buy the nails.
That's for sure.
That's such a good point. You know, I started thinking, like, what you were saying, that, you know, a lot of people don't know how to do, you know, stairs or cut stairs and design them. So with now, today's technology, is it all done, like, computerized where it's, you know, pre-cut, or is it?
Well, yeah, we had trusses from the very beginning, but now it's gotten to the point where the truss yards, many of them have gotten so good that they can basically cut trusses for any roof design.
Yeah.
And there's very little fill that can't be actually done by an engineered truss yard.
Now, I will tell you that I learned this when I was a firefighter, and that was that truss construction is incredibly strong.
Correct.
Very, very strong.
As long as it's done right.
Well, yes, I would agree with that. However, it fails very quick in a fire.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whereas the traditional roofing is, what'd you call it? Stack and
cut and stack.
Cut and stack.
Yeah.
it will hold up much longer in a fire. So it changed the firefighting perspective from how long you could actually do interior operations on a home with truss construction, because that roof is going to give way much quicker.
Yeah. So, well, if there was an attic fire in a trussed roof, I wouldn't want to get on that roof to fire from the roof. And I don't think that they really do anymore. You used to see firefighters get up on the roof and cut through the roofing and ventilate and just get water out from above. And that would be really dangerous on a trussed roof.
Do you feel that carpentry is a dying trait?
To some degree. I don't think it's ever going to completely die, because there's always going to be some kind of demand for, you know, like in the finishes and cabinetry and but there are building materials coming along now where your conventional stud framing is going to become less and less. The house that I'm working on right now is actually the exterior of the house is 11.5-inch wide walls that are 2.5 inches of foam on each side, or 2.25-inch foam on each side, and 6 inches of concrete in the center that's steel reinforced. It's called an ICF system. And I could give a plug to Fox Blocks, but I won't do that. it gives you a really, really superior exterior to the house. However, it costs more than framing.
Yeah.
But you also have a thick wall.
I was going to say, yeah.
Insulation.
Yeah. Insulation value. And so anyway, there are more alternative systems coming along on a daily basis. There's some guy that actually is in Texas that does it with a computer program where it just rolls out concrete.
Yeah, that's the 3D printing.
Yes, the 3D printing. Yeah.
Yeah. I was watching on TV, I think it was yesterday, you know, where, you know, they're making now 3D homes when they come, in containers, and then you just put them together. So that's...
Yeah.
So the material that you're talking about, what's it called?
That one is ICF, Fox Blocks.
Okay. Is that like prefab?
It comes in, the blocks come, they're like yay. I don't know exact dimension, even though I look at it every day. They're about like yay. And
for those listening and not seeing the video, it's about 18 inches by.
Yeah, it's they're probably 12 by 18.
Okay.
It's essentially like building a block wall.
Okay.
And then you get your reinforcing steel, and then you pour concrete into it.
Okay.
So it's like building a wall.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I think there's a perfect example where if you're in that, you have to evolve, right? Mm-hmm. We see it all the time in HVAC, you know, some of the technology coming in and it's changing. Just like you used to have shade tree mechanics, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody could work on a car. Now you need special tools, special diagnostic tools.
Yeah.
A lot more stuff is becoming proprietary.
Correct.
Yeah. And we're seeing that in HVAC and some of the other trades. But to your point, though, there are aspects of carpentry that I think will always be with us, especially, and a really good craftsman will always have work.
Yeah, I believe that.
You know, I think the ones that just go out there and bang stuff together, and don't know how to hit a hammer, don't know how to do all that other stuff, a little different. But a good craftsman, tradesman, yeah, I think will always have a place in this world.
And you always got to start with reading a tape.
Yeah, I know how to read a tape.
Oh, my God. 1, 2, 3, 4 little lines.
It is amazing. You know what? It's not taught in school like it used to be. And it's taught in a classroom, like arithmetic, versus going to shop class and actually being able to put it into practice, measuring, and do it real time.
Well, the beauty of doing it in school is you get out of your geometry class. You know, you got your math class, and you're learning geometry, and then you go into shop, and right away you got a square and a tape measure, and you're figuring angles, and it's much easier to learn when you can tangibly apply the skills you're just learning.
And I believe too that, you know, most people that are in their trades, you know, and I'll speak for myself as well, when it comes to the learning aspect of it, like I got to be able to do it, because if I read it, like I don't read a lot, so. But if I hear it and I see it, then I could duplicate it. And it's very easy for me to learn. And I think most people that are in the trades are the same way of learning.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of trades people, as we know, are kinesthetic, right? And so they've got to be active. And they've got to learn that way. So that's the hands-on approach is teaching somebody to read a tape measure in a classroom only goes so far. Mm-hmm. But teaching them how to read a tape measure, hands-on application, totally different.
Yeah. Which, I think that's what started the idea with us, with our technicians in our training room, because everything was being taught in the classroom, but hands-on, they really didn't grasp it until we had a training room where they could go in the training room and actually work on the systems themselves.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier to learn.
In your time, quite a few years in carpentry, what are some of the biggest changes you've seen? Like not just in building materials, but maybe the type of people coming in, the quality of things, whatever it may be.
Well, there's an evolution in tools, which is good. I'll address that first. It used to be that we go to a job site as framers or as carpenters. The first thing we do is we'll roll out our cords, that 100 footers and get the compressor out and this and that and the other thing. Now these guys come and they've got these battery powered saws. They don't even need to roll out a cord. Almost everything is battery operated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a game changer. So myself, I have so many tools accumulated over the years that require cords.
Well,
I'm not at my age going to go invest in all that stuff, but that's been a game changer. But it's also that, unfortunately, a lot of the guys that are leading the crews might have pretty good skills themselves, but they don't spend, in my opinion, as I watch framing companies and different guys operate, it seems like guys are good at one thing, like just putting on hardware or nailing on the hardware. There's been a trend where things aren't nailed as good as possible as they should be, and so now we just add more nails. Now, Simpson came along a few years ago and started developing all this hardware, and every set of plans you look at, I used to be able to bid on a house, even a custom house, and maybe there'd be $1,000 worth of hardware in the house. Mm-hmm. Now it's more like 25, 30 grand in it.
Wow.
In a house, because there's more hold downs and so there, for earthquake. Stuff and straps and hangers, and there's just everywhere you look, there's metal. So that creates challenges for the guys that have to cover that up, whether it's a stucco guy or a drywaller or, where you used to have good fastening everywhere because it's all wood behind you, right? Now they have more challenges because of that. So you have somewhat of a loss of overall workmanship and quality, product quality, based on the specific challenges that are created by putting too much metal into a wood building. That's just my opinion on it. But some other guys think other things. But you have to accommodate all that, because every time that you've got to, I don't mean to ramble, but you told me to ramble. But like in a house, a typical house now, when the drywaller comes in, he's got to accommodate for hangers that might be hanging down a quarter of an inch, straps that might be protruding a quarter of an inch. And they have to either hollow out the back of that material, which of course is going to weaken the material to a degree, or the wall has to be furred,
yes.
The ceiling has to be furred, and so there's trade off. Sure, your engineers love the stuff, but it makes it tougher on the builder,
It sounds like it puts a little bit more work into it.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
Yeah.
But these are changes all, especially in California, that have come about to make dwellings safer.
Yeah, right? For the most part, it's for earthquake.
Yeah,
survivability.
Oh, but what's the biggest house you built that you framed?
48,000.
Wow, that's a big one.
Yeah. Yeah, the one I'm doing right now is not that big. No, it's really relatively small, but it looks big because it's got real high ceilings. So, and we do commercial stuff too. So.
Okay.
Most all your work's in the desert area right now?
Yeah, although we had a really nice job here a couple of years back. The guys that I work with and I went to Bel Air and redid the Bel Air Country Club clubhouse.
Oh, really?
Now, it was an interesting sort of a setup because there was metal stud framing, there was wood stud roofing, all that. We got there. The structure was basically in place, and we went in and put huge beams. These things weighing 1,700 to 1,800 pounds a piece, and we had to boom them and use mechanical lifts to move them around inside the building. And we built another roof underneath the roof.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a little job. We got a lot of video.
I was going to say that.
Shout out to Dave Young.
Very interesting. So doing, is it any different doing the, you know, besides like the nails and using screws from, you know, the wood framing versus metal framing?
Well, metal framing, you're using screws instead of nails.
You think it's more challenging, or is it?
You know, the guys that do a lot of metal stud framing say it's easier. For me, I would rather work with wood. But it's familiarity is all.
Okay. Yeah.
And there's a limit to what you can do in metal stud framing. You can do short little beam areas, like you could do a header or a door,
but not
with metal stud, but you can't really do a long span.
Okay.
That way. It would have to be a structural steel or lumber.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about lessons learned through the years.
I want to hear your lessons learned in life, business, you know, carpentry. Because I think they all kind of tie together.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Well, certainly in carpentry, the biggest thing is safety first. You know, learn your skills, but it's safety first. I was telling you guys before that I've only had one serious injury in my entire career. That was in 79. I had a finger smashed. I learned the lesson to keep my hand out of the way of the forklift. But the other thing is, we used to, when we framed walls, we would lift them by hand. And we had something happen up in Ironwood Country Club, and I've got to be real careful. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but these were huge walls, and we had a crew of about 10 guys, and we were raising them by hand, but we had a machine sitting there idly with a strap and everything. All we really needed to do was to lift the wall safely. We still, all of us would be on the wall to place it, but it needed to have that machine to keep it from falling, because unfortunately what happened in this case, we got up to a certain point, and the bottom of the wall came off of the bolts that we were pressing against. And when that happened, most of us knew, okay, we were losing the wall. And like myself, I just twisted between two studs, and the wall ended up coming down, and it grabbed my nail bags and drove me down to my knees. But I only got minor injuries. But one of the guys decided to let go of the wall and try and run. And the wall caught him on each shoulder like this, and wow, he was killed.
Oh, man.
Right there in front of us. And it didn't have to happen, because safety first. There should have been. Now nobody does that. We use machines. And we still lift a lot of walls by hand. But anything like that, is you've got to have a machine assist.
Yeah.
But that's like the greatest lesson. You don't want anybody getting hurt.
No. And that we stress that all the time. Like, listen, go home to your families. There is nothing that we do that is worth getting hurt over or losing your life over. Mm. And we have a motto that we preach, and it's make the call, right? You make the call. And if you feel it's unsafe, it's unsafe, mm-hmm, right? If it's a normal application, but for some reason you don't feel right about it, that's your call.
Yeah.
Right. And then we'll figure it out. And then if somebody is, I don't care who it is trying to make you do something that you feel is unsafe, I'm like, come right to me or Francisco.
Yeah.
Because safety first, man. Just go home to your family.
Absolutely.
Unscathed. So I like that. I don't think that can be stressed enough.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So you're talking to some young people, maybe young people in the trades in general, or young people that are considering a career in the trades or in the trades and maybe even carpentry. What advice would you give them with all your years of wisdom and experience, besides be safe?
Well, you know, you should have a backup plan. It's great. You can make a good living in the trades, but you need to have multiple skills and save your money. It's tough when a young guy gets out there and the first time he pulls in a nice fat check, you know, they want to
blow it. I've been there.
It's easy to spend money. It's easier to spend money than it is to make it. So try and save it. Have a plan for retirement. And it's good to know more than one trade. I was fortunate enough to have a little taste of everything. And so, yes, I am a carpenter, but I'm also a retired general contractor. I'm, you know, could be a handyman very easily. But that's because of being well-rounded. The other thing is, yes, safety first, have other options. And I would say stay loyal. Yeah, there's a period of time out here where I saw a lot of backstabbing going on. You know, guys would go around and trash other guys' work and stuff like that. I really don't see the benefit in that. So no matter what you're doing, you know, show respect for the other guys, even if they're your competitors. It's one thing I appreciate about you, Pat, is that you do that. And I try and do the same. You know, I don't want to bash anybody, even though I could.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. And, yeah, always, you know, you're going to have competitors, and don't go to the level that some people go to. And loyalty is really important. And we're sometimes our own worst enemy to our profession.
Did you have any mentors as you were going through the, you know, through your journey?
Oh, yeah, that's, I'm glad you asked that question, because I was really fortunate when I was 20, still fairly new carpenter. I had two guys in their 60s, my age, that I did one remodel with these two guys. And the one guy who was the boss, he'd come in with his cup of coffee every morning and tell me what to do and line me up, and he set me with Tony or set me with the other guy, and he taught me how to hang doors and how to do concrete and how to do cabinets and how to frame, of course. And I learned more in that 8 months working with those two old guys than in the rest of my career. And I took it and was able to teach it to multiple other younger men. But it's funny, because in those days, that was probably 78, 79, 80, somewhere in there. Long time ago. The guy in charge would pull up in his old Chevy Bronco. And some of you who know me, who know who this guy is. And he would have a cup of coffee, and I could smell it 10 feet away that he that it wasn't just coffee. But that was a thing back then. You know, a lot of painters all were alcoholics in those days because of the chemicals of the paint, all that stuff. And nowadays, you got to be sober on the job. You've got to be sober on the job. That's
Times have definitely changed in that respect. The evolution of just, how things were in the 70s and 80s and even 90s, and we just evolve. And we usually evolve because we get smarter, mm-hmm. right? And I think one of the things you said, too, was about saving your money. I remember I was doing a landscape job back in Pennsylvania, and we were working with this old mason, right? Guy was nearing 70, and he was tough as nails. And we were put in a patio. And we're laying brick, and it was me and a couple buddies I went to high school with. We've landscaped, and he's like, "Listen, I'm going to give you some advice." He says, "Now, nobody listens to this advice, but if you listen to it, it'll change your life, save your money." He said, "Don't waste it on a bunch of your girlfriends." He's like, save your money, he said. And so to hear you say that as well, and I see these young kids that they get into the trades and make money. They're still living at home, right? And it's like, man, now is the time. Save. Because what they don't realize is once they get on their own and do this and that, that money doesn't go as far. And if you can save now, if you can spend 5, 6, 10 years just save, it changes the rest of your life.
That's for sure.
But the challenge is when you're young like that, you know, you think you know everything, you want to have a good time, and you don't really realize how fast time moves. Mm-hmm. You think, I'm only 18, I'm only 20 or 22 or whatever.
And then next thing you know, you're 30.
Yeah.
We have a friend that has a very successful contracting business in Texas. And he would have guys come and ask for loans, right? Hey, can I get an advance of my paycheck or a loan? And he got to a point where in order to grant it, they had to go to this guy they had that was kind of like a coach, right? And they'd say, yeah, but you got to go talk to him. So they go talk to him, and this guy would say, okay, I need all your bank statements for like the last 60 days. A lot of them didn't have bank accounts. And in that case, he's okay, I need you to write down for the next week everything you spend money on, save the receipt, bring it in. And this one kid was making, at the time, I think it was like $1,500 a week, right? A young kid. And found out he was spending almost all of it
he would like, he'd go to 7-Eleven, buy a bunch of Slurpees to take to the job to get to his buddies, or he'd go out with his buddies and he'd pay for stuff. And he was, and he wasn't, he didn't realize until it was in front of him how he was pissing money away.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the, and it, if young people can understand investing your money, the power of the compounded interest, the power of investing in the right things, getting to a point where you by the time you're 40, you've put enough money away in the right things. Now you've got a passive income coming in. It changes the game. And I believe young people coming into the trades, they have no college debt. Mm-hmm. They're making the type of money that their college friends are going to make coming out of college, right?
Yeah.
With debt. And they're going to have no debt. They're making really good money now. And if they spent that time investing it and not pissing it away, it can change their fantasy.
Especially when they're still living at home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a game changer. It's like, man. So I think that's great. I think that's great advice. I think every piece of advice you gave is what people need to hear. And now the challenge is always hearing and doing, mm-hmm. right? Hearing
and doing. Zero is the hardest thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Francisco, any final questions? Comments?
I was, one was, about the mentor. The other one was, what advice would you give to yourself? Like looking at where you're at today mm-hmm. and when you were 20.
Man, it's a book. It's a book. But if I could boil it down to one thing, form the habit of getting up early, working hard with your hands all day, feeling good about what you do, getting a good night's sleep. Rinse and repeat.
Yeah, amen to that.
Yep.
Rinse and repeat.
Amen to that. So if you're listening to the Tradepreneur Show, which I hope you are, or you're watching us, that advice right there, worth its weight in gold. It could be a game changer. It can be a game changer. So,
It is. I'll speak from personal experience. I was used to going to bed at 10, 11, midnight. And I was always, waking up at 6 in the morning, like tired.
Right.
Now my average time, I go to bed, around 8:30 to 9. My wife will say 7 o'clock, but it's 8:30 to 9. Mm-hmm. But I'm up at 4 o'clock, ready to go and excited, to go to work.
Yeah. It's your body. Your body gets used to whatever your rhythm is and your circadian kicks in. So it's about getting a good night's rest.
But I woke up like at 3 in the morning just so excited because I was going to be here.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is that hard day's work. I will tell you, there's nothing better than putting in a hard day's work and going home and sitting down on the couch or your recliner and you're just you're almost automatically falling asleep. Mm-hmm. It is such a feeling of accomplishment and it's a healthy hard work. That's the one thing I think we've moved away from as a country is taking away the value of that hard work, that labor, There's something to be said for it, and it's what's built this country. So,
absolutely.
Well, with that said, Tim, I really appreciate you coming and sharing your wisdom.
Thanks for the invite.
Thank you.
Great being
with you. Francisco, I really appreciate you.
I'm willing
to co-host. We've got this individual. His name is Michael Burke. That is the wizard behind the lights and the sound and everything like that. And Fina, she puts it all together, edits it, and so we can put out a good show. I really hope you're enjoying the show. I'd appreciate you listening. Would love to, if you like the show, comment on it. That really helps us be able to get this show out to more people. And of course, anywhere you find a podcast, you'll find us, and we're also on YouTube. So until next time, be great, and in the words of Tim, be safe.